This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As a typical meat-eating, beer-swilling, milk-guzzling Westerner, my guest Fred Pierce figures he consumes as much as 100 times his own weight in water every day. No, he doesn't drink or shower that much. He's counting the amount of water it takes for the crops and the cattle that feed him. When you look at water this way, you can see why Pierce thinks that water is the defining crisis of the 21st century. In his new book, When the Rivers Run Dry, Pierce writes about the environmental and political issues surrounding water. He's been writing about water issues for over 20 years. He's a former editor at New Scientist and is currently its environment and development consultant. Now, you measure water not just in terms of the water we drink and cook with and bathe with. You measure it in terms of the water we use to grow crops and feed the animals that are slaughtered for meat. The amount of water we use when we look at it that way is really startling. Would you give us some examples?
It's scary. We always think about maybe how we waste water when we flush the toilet or run a tap or so on. But really, it's the amount of water that we use in our homes is very small compared to the amount of water that we need to get through our lives. Most of that water, and this is true really around the world, is used for growing crops, is used for irrigating crops, for formal irrigation systems or however it's done. So, for instance, the pound of rice you buy in the shop, now that's typically uses 500 gallons of water to grow that rice. Wheat for bread or whatever purpose, 100 gallons, 130 gallons, something of that sort. Milk, 500 gallons to produce a gallon of milk. Now that's...
So it's 500 gallons to feed the grain to the cow that's going to produce the milk.
Yeah, we're getting into complications when you're dealing with animals, but basically this is the water needed to grow the crops, to feed to the animals, to provide whether it's meat or milk or cheese or whatever it is we're producing. And you know that for that, a pound of coffee requires 10 tons of water to grow. To me, and I didn't come across these numbers till a couple of years ago when I started researching this book, these were quite staggering numbers. I had no idea that we used so much water.
Now, a lot of the water that's used for crops is, of course, rainwater, but a lot of the water used for crops is not rainwater. Go ahead.
That's right. I mean, the rainwater, of course, if it's used for crops, doesn't necessarily get into rivers. However it's collected, it can have effects. But it's certainly true that the biggest effects are caused when you have to dam rivers or pump water from underground in order to supply water for formal irrigation schemes to keep crops growing. So in the arid lands of the world, that's where you most need to irrigate. So that's where the pressures are so great. We're simply emptying rivers in order to feed ourselves. Well, irrigation is one of those hugely inefficient technologies. We're used to having a lot of water around, and traditionally farmers would simply flood their fields to irrigate crops. These days we're generally, or in many places, a little more sophisticated. We use spray irrigation very often. But even so, huge amounts of water are wasted. Usually it's evaporated. Sometimes it percolates underground. Now, sometimes you can pump that up again. It's expensive to pump it, but you can do it.
Well, when water is diverted from a river for irrigation, is there any way of preventing a lot of it being lost to evaporation?
It's a little hard. If you put it in a pipe, it won't evaporate, that's for sure, but that's quite expensive. The most modern sophisticated irrigation systems are pretty good. They're drip irrigation systems. They will tend to put water in a pipe rather than in a canal so that you don't have the evaporation from the surface of the canal. And then once it gets to the fields, you don't want to have it sitting around at the surface of the field on top of the soil in the middle of the day when the sun's at its hottest. So it's a good idea to deliver the water directly to the roots. Now, that's where you want the water. You don't want the water flooding the field. You don't want it waterlogging the soil. You actually want to deliver water to the roots of the crops. The Israelis are very good at it. The Jordanians are getting quite good at it. Some other countries have taken the lead in this. I have to say that I don't think the US is a leader in this, certainly across most of the country. But countries are beginning to realize that you have to be rather smarter about how you use water. Otherwise, you run out, and then you have crop losses, crop failures, and so on. It becomes a serious economic matter.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Fred Pierce. He's the author of the new book, When the Rivers Run Dry. It's about water and the crisis of water. Obviously, desert countries have unique problems when it comes to water. Some deserts have terrific underground supplies of water. Would you just briefly describe how underground aquifers end up in desert areas?
It's one of the strange features of the hydrology of the world that some of the biggest underground reserves of water are in some of the driest regions. The two biggest underground reserves indeed are under the Sahara Desert in North Africa and under the Arabian Desert, two of the driest places of the world. This is really simply because climate's changed. Until about 6,000 years ago, the Sahara region was really quite wet. There were huge rivers and wadis, and you know, where there is now sand dunes, there were crocodiles. So it was a wet area, and large amounts of that water percolated down through the soils into big sandstone areas underneath. Now, sandstone is quite porous, and it can hold a lot of water. And that water is still there. In the last couple of decades, the Libyans in particular have been pumping very large amounts of water out to irrigate crops. The Saudis have been doing much the same thing. So this is a major resource. It can be quite expensive to pump to the surface because much of it is quite a long way down. And it is a finite resource. There is only so much water there. And the more you pump out, it tends to get salty and various chemical problems can emerge. But it's a major resource. But of course, it's a fossil resource. It's not being replaced. In some parts of the world, if you pump the water out, more rain will replace it. Those kind of places, it's not replaced. Once you've used it, it's gone. You're mining water.
So in that sense, it's a lot like oil.
Very much like oil. As I was talking earlier about how we have a water cycle in which water, it rains to the ground and flows down rivers and goes out to the sea and evaporates and goes back into the sky and comes back as rain. A detour of that can be if the water goes underground, but much of that underground water comes to the surface in springs and forms rivers, or we pump it to the surface and use it for irrigation. But there are large reserves of water which have simply gone down there sometimes thousands of years ago and simply stayed there.
And Libya is creating what's been described as a man-made river. What are they doing with these underground water supplies?
They're pumping it to the surface, and they have a huge network of large pipes big enough to drive a truck through, which bring the water from the desert. The water is quite deep in the desert, by which I mean, you know, a couple of thousand kilometers you drive into the desert before you find the big water well fields. So they've built well fields, pump the water to the surface, pour it into these pipes and take it to the coastal regions where their farmers are desperate for water because they've used up their own underground reserves. It's a very large scheme. It's cost tens of billions of dollars. Much of it designed by US and UK companies.
Including Halliburton?
Halliburton was certainly deeply involved in it, yes. Korean manufacturers built the pipes. So big international effort, which rather quietly has been going on over the last 30 years through you know, all sorts of political conditions.
So basically, Libya is using a lot of its oil revenues to get water.
Yeah. Gaddafi decided to invest a great deal of his oil revenues in delivering water to the surface. His idea was he would be using this short-term flux of money from the oil to provide a long-term future for his people. Many people think it won't work out that way because the costs are really very high. It's kind of fantasy economics. Now, maybe that worked when you were a closed socialist state that set your own prices for things, but now Libya is moving into the international market. It's not so clear whether this will carry on. I think Libyans may well find that it'll be cheaper to import their water in the form of crops, if you like. So they'll buy the crops rather than pumping up the water to grow their own crops. And that might, economically, in a free market, make more sense. But certainly it's, in engineering terms, a quite extraordinary enterprise.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Fred Pierce. We're talking about his new book, When the Rivers Run Dry, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. One option for desert countries that are near oceans is desalination. How effective and environmentally safe is desalination?
The main problem with desalination is it's expensive. It uses a lot of energy. Now, there are two ways of doing it. You can either distill water, which is essentially putting all the water in a kettle and boiling it up and taking the water vapor that comes out and taking that back into water and delivering that to your customers. Or you can use a process called reverse osmosis, which is essentially filtering. You blast the water through filters, which take out the salt, so you're left with fresh water. Either system uses a lot of energy, and therefore the water costs, though they're coming down, are still very high. This system has been mainly used in the Gulf states and in Saudi Arabia, where it's been they've had plenty of oil supplies cheaply available locally, so they can cope with the energy costs. As prices come down, other places are coming in. Perth in Australia, Cape Town in South Africa, one or two cities in Santa Cruz, I think, in California, has been looking at this in building desalination plants. So it's beginning to come more mainstream, and perhaps 2-3% of all the water that we use for drinking purposes around the world now comes from desalination. It's still too expensive for irrigation and for agriculture, but if you're short of water for drinking, then it's a reasonable option.
My guest is Fred Pierce. His new book is called When the Rivers Run Dry. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Fred Pierce. His new book is called When the Rivers Run Dry, Water, the Defining Crisis of the 21st Century. Now, in the United States, we have a lot of old development in arid areas like Los Angeles and newer development in arid areas like Phoenix. Mm-hmm. You looked at Phoenix for your book. What do you see there in terms of the water future?
It's a kind of crazy water city in the middle of the desert. What strikes you about Phoenix, and I think it's probably true of LA as well, is the way that water is kind of a status symbol. You have fountains, and you irrigate all your parks through the day. You flaunt your water. Everybody wants a swimming pool. Now, that's kind of understandable. It's a great swimming pool's a great thing to have if you're sweltering in the desert. But there's a kind of flaunting of water that goes on there, which is, given how little water there is crazy. So both LA and, or both Southern California and Phoenix rely a lot on water piped in and brought in by canal from the River Colorado. And the River Colorado is classically a river that's running dry. So there are serious limits here, particularly in the last few years when the flow in the Colorado seems to have been reducing. Maybe that's due to climate change, maybe not. Maybe it's a long-term, maybe it's a short-term phenomenon, but it begins to look a bit long-term. And that is a serious problem which the various states that use the water from the River Colorado are going to have to resolve between them. And that may mean that cities like Phoenix, which are quite a long way from the river, and are going to have to think carefully about whether they can carry on relying on water from the Colorado. And if they're not, then where else are they going to get their water from? There is water underground there, but it's quite limited. There are efforts to conserve water more in Phoenix and its suburbs than a few years ago. But even so, these are some of the biggest water users in the U.S., which is one of the biggest water users on the planet. And they're sitting in the middle of a desert, and there really are some limits.
Let's talk about one of the big victories in water conservation, and that happens in our bathrooms with our flush toilets. Mm. You say we used to use 3.4 gallons to flush a toilet, and now we're using 1.6. So that's pretty darn good. How did we do it?
I'm not an American, so I don't know exactly how you did it. I'm impressed, though, because over in Europe, we have a sense of Americans that, you know, you just use all your resources and you let rip and you don't care and you don't have any controls. And it's all a little bit too much of a free market for the taste of some Europeans. And yet, in the U.S., you've made much more progress in simple techniques of saving water from your flush toilet than we have in Europe. I think you just had some civic authorities who set some new rules about what a proper design of a toilet flush system should be, and they've been adopted. I was in Canada about a year ago, and it turns out that they haven't followed the same rules as you have. So old U.S. flush toilets that are no longer legal in the U.S., there's now a kind of black market in them going over to Canada. And the Canadians have suddenly woken up to the fact that as a result, they are now bigger per capita water users than the U.S. That you've in the last 20 years, you've swapped places in the U.S. Per capita use of water in the home has really not changed at all, whereas in Canada, it's soared simple matter of a few basic laws and regulations have changed that. So you've done pretty well.
Do you think we have zestier flushes to compensate for the lesser amount of water?
Well, maybe you do. I think it's just a matter of design. It's the complex design of the pipes and the flush mechanism, which means that you can get away with using less water and still have an effective flush, because there's nothing more that you don't want than is an ineffective flush. But you seem to have managed it. I think it's just basic good design and sensible regulations.
You know, so many people in the United States certainly drink bottled water. I always wonder what effect that's having on water ecology around the world, and what's happening to all the springs that we're drinking when we drink the spring water.
I think probably most of the springs do manage to keep going because they're pretty productive to start with. But it's a crazy way to buy water for a start. It costs so much compared to what you get out of the tap. Now, if the tap water is unsafe, that's one thing. But if the tap water is safe and you still drink bottled water, I think that's just plain crazy.
Wait, let me stop you. You might not understand that sometimes the tap water is safe. It just doesn't taste very good.
Well, if you have rather inefficient and poor chlorination systems for disinfecting the water, then, yeah, sure, that can affect the taste. The answer, I think, is a more effective disinfection system so that you don't communally have those kind of problems. In environmental terms, I think the damage is not so much that you're destroying local water supplies, though I'd guess locally that can happen, so much as the amount of energy that you use carting this water around in trucks around the world. So you're probably not destroying the rivers so much as destroying the climate by all these greenhouse gases. It's a crazy way to operate, but, you know, we live in a crazy world.
You've pointed out how much water we use in irrigating crops in arid lands, and also in growing the grain that's used to, say, feed the cattle that we eat for steak and hamburgers. So are things out of proportion in a way that we could change? I mean, do you think we should stop growing rice in arid countries? Should we stop growing cotton in arid countries?
I think we have to think about how we breed our crops. I remember 30 years ago when I was pretty young, but I remember huge stories about how the world wasn't going to be able to feed itself anymore, and thousands of millions of people were going to starve for want of water to grow, or want of crops, want of food. Great crisis 30 years ago. Well, scientists came up with a new generation of crops, what they called the Green Revolution crops, which were high-yielding varieties of rice and wheat and barley and so on. Well, we fed the people, but those crops turned out to be huge users of water. Compared to 30 years ago, we grow twice as much food as we did then, feeding a population of the world twice as large, but we use three times as much water to do it. So those new super crops, the high-yielding Green Revolution crops, were highly productive, measured on the amount of land, so you get more tonnage per acre of land. But you got less tonnage often for the amount of water that you used. So the next revolution, I think, has got to be not a green revolution, but a blue revolution, in which we start engineering crops, breeding crops, which will be efficient in their use of water as well. We can solve a lot of problems if we do that.
Well, Fred Pierce, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Fred Pierce is the author of the new book, When the Rivers Run Dry.